Okay, this which is Parashat Pikudei. So rabbis all over the world are perturbed because they generally don't have to speak about Parashat Pikudei. There's a couple of ways out over here. One way out is you put it together with Vayakhel, which is not a complete solution by itself. The other thing is that because these Parashiot were so unexciting, the rabbis created the four Parashiot. And therefore, there's always a backup plan that you have. You're laughing at me. Okay. So maybe that was not the intended consequence, but it was an unintended consequence. But at the end of the day, we have something else to talk about. So it's, oh, I really wanted to talk about Pikudei, but instead we have Parshat Zachar to talk about. So let's talk about Amalek, if that's more exciting. So we can't do that. So I do plan on talking about Parshat Pikudei, as surprising as this will be. The challenge is, and I think I may have said this at the beginning of last week as well, the challenge is that it's repetitive and not exciting. Meaning one or the other I can deal with, but you have Truma and Tetzaveh telling us about the building of the Mishkan and about the Kohen Gadol and the Kohen clothing, and now you have the actual implementation of this. So Rabbi Lichtenstein had explained by using an analogy of a wedding. He said, let's say if a couple and they meet, well, it depends on which generation. I'm going to say they fall in love or they decide to get married. I don't know where to put the love in all of this. Nobody say anything over here. That's okay. Anyway, they decide to get married. We'll just leave it at that. They decide to get married, and everything is wonderful, and everything is great, and then they order all of the things for the wedding. Right? Obviously, back in the day, they had Bed Bath and Beyond or something, and they had this thing called a registry, and they had a registry, and they'll get a table, and they'll get a menorah, and they'll get a, what else? They'll get a mizbeach, just in case he doesn't behave, and they'll have all the things they need in order to make a beautiful home. And then, lo and behold, right before the wedding, the chassan goes up, or I would say the chassan, the Shushvanin, which is actually the way it's explained, Moshe, goes up for and is on away for 40 days. And as when the bride is on her own, she goes and cheats with a golden calf. Now, that could or should have ruined everything. And somehow, they get forgiven. Now, you would think that the wedding, which was originally planned, which will now take place anyway, will not be the same kind of wedding. It's not going to be this big fanfare and so on, because there is this stain of the sin in the background. They'll have a little, you know, reception, maybe just immediate relatives and so on. But you can't go and make a whole big wedding after what has happened. And that's the message where the Chassidim said was about Vayakim Pikudei, is that after Kodesh Baruch Hu forgave the Jewish people, every single thing that was bought and ordered and arrived and unpacked and put inside the Mishkan, every single thing is being treated with the same kind of love and appreciation and dedication, devotion, had the sin had ever taken place. So he used that as a metaphor to explain why we have all the details now, post-sin of the golden calf, and it wouldn't have been enough, because we could have done all of this in one pasuk. And the Jews did everything that God said. Like you don't need anything else. That's all that you would have needed. So, you know, normally, you know, we look at a pasuk and say, okay, this word is a little extra, this word's a little extra. The whole parsha is extra, right? Except for maybe the conclusion. And one of the things I want to get to today is I had worked very hard in terms of Sefer Bereishit to show that Sefer Bereishit ended on a happy note. And if any of you possibly remember, I actually worked very hard to show that Vayikra ended on a happy note. Clearly you don't remember. And I had worked very hard. And I don't know how hard I have to work to show that Shemot ends on a happy note, but I do want to understand what that happy note is. Because it could very well be that the happy note of Vayikra and Shemot are really the same note. So that could be actually quite interesting. So let's begin at the beginning. Pasuk Kaf Aleph, which is Lamed Chet Kaf Aleph, beginning of the parasha, source number one. Eile Pikudei HaMishkan, Mishkan Eidut, Ashepukad Alpi Moshe. Now, by the way, that would have been enough of a pasuk, although it's only half of the pasuk, and there were too many words. Eile Pikudei HaMishkan, Mishkan Eidut, Ashepukad Alpi Moshe. Yes, do you realize why there are too many words there? We could really have cut this down. Avodat HaLevi'im B'yad Itamar Ben Aaron HaKohen. So now we have Moshe is the one who's doing the pikud, we'll call it right now, but it's not the right word. You have Itamar ben Aaron HaKohen, who's involved, which is also really interesting, because until now we never had Itamar ben Aaron HaKohen in this leadership position. We would have expected, if you would have said, okay, pick somebody as a Kohen who's going to be involved, we would have picked Aaron. Ubetzalel ben Uri ben Chur l'matei Yehuda. Okay, so now we have another person. Now, he doesn't come as a total surprise because we already heard about him back in Perek Lamed Aleph, but let's make believe we didn't. Asot kol asher tziva Hashem et Moshe. Ve'ito, and here we have another person, Oholiav ben Achisamach l'matei Dan. So let's admit it, you never saw him coming, right? And if I would have told you to pick someone else, he would not have been your first, second, or third, or even 10th pick, because you would have no idea that he was even a free agent. You didn't even know that he was somebody who could be picked. And I guess what's intriguing over here is that we have a group of four. The group of four is Moshe, Itamar, Bezalel, and Oholiav. Groups of four Moshe represents whatever he represents. Then you have somebody representing the Kohanim, and somebody representing the tribe of Yehuda, and then somebody representing the tribe of Dan. If we break it down into tribes, which one is the hardest one to explain? I hope I already said that, and you already heard that, and that's the tribe of Dan. Now, the other three, what would be the common denominator of the other three, if you needed to choose a common denominator, and you do need to choose one, what would have been the common denominator? Not good enough? Yes, true. True. What? All this is good, but when do you see the three of them working together before? In the war against Amalek. See that? I got back to Parshat Zachar. Good, right? I said I wasn't going to do that, but what can I do? It just now forced itself upon me. So the war against Amalek did have those three. Actually, had a fourth person, and who was the fourth person? The first person was Yehoshua from the tribe of Ephraim, from the tribe of Yosef. So therefore, if I were to then to say, just to suggest, as a remote possibility, that maybe somehow, some way, that Oholiav from Dan somehow is a, what word do you want to use? A proxy for Yehoshua coming from Yosef. Does that work for you at all? And you're saying, no, that's because you're an amateur. Because I'm a professional. You say, no. Excuse me? Don't try this at home. But why doesn't it work? Because it just doesn't work. So how do we force it? No, this is not going to be forced. This is going to be very, very gentle and obvious. So we need to go back a little bit. So who exactly is Dan? Okay, good. You had the right answer to the wrong question. I will try to change my question in order to make sure that you give the right answer. Actually, I'll ask a different question. This is for you now. What is the connection between Yehuda and Dan? Is there any connection between those two tribes? One second. Let's try again now. Go ahead. There you go. Right answer. See? This was totally... I take full responsibility for the wrong answers. There's another connection between the two of them. Actually, more obvious. So yeah, even though I led you to think that was the right answer, wrong answer. What's the right answer? The connection between Yehuda and Dan? They're both called the same thing. The other one. That was 50-50 ahead on that. They're both called Gur Aryeh. Yaakov calls Yehuda a Gur Aryeh, and Moshe calls Dan a Gur Aryeh. So they're both Gur Aryehs. So that itself is very interesting, and that needs to be understood. It's very fair. And I asked what they have in common. They're both called Gur Aryeh. So again, this is the right answer. You want? I'll change the question to make you happier. Okay, I'll change the question. Which two tribes are both called by different people Gur Aryeh? Okay, now you like it? So do we now realize that, by the way, this is completely wrong direction, because I asked you what was the connection between Dan and Yosef, and now we're working too hard on what is the connection between Dan and Yehuda. So therefore, we're halfway there, but we don't know where we are. So that's really good. When we get there, we may not be happy. So let's try again. I'll try this. Again, I really ask easy questions. Does the tribe of Dan have anything to do whatsoever with the tribe of Yosef? And I actually phrased it in a much better way before. I said that in some way, the tribe of Dan is now acting as a proxy to the tribe, to the tribe, good, right answer, to the tribe of Yosef. So is there any way that that actually makes sense? So what's the answer? Answer is?
Yes.
Yes. The answer is yes. That makes sense. Why does that make sense? Source 13. Vatera Rachel ki lo yalada liyakov. Rachel saw that she was not blessed with any children. Vatikane Rachel ba'achota. There was jealousy towards her sister. Vatomer el Yaakov haveli banim v'im ayin meta nochi havali banim. And she says, bring me children. If not, I'm dead. V'yicharaf Yaakov b'rachel v'yomer atachet elokim anochi. Hashem anam mimech pri ba'ata. And he goes, is this my fault? She's upset because when Rivka and Yitzchak don't have children, then Yitzchak goes and prays, and she feels that Yaakov should have done more. And perhaps she even feels, well, you already have a kid with someone else, and that someone else is my sister, and that sister of mine only became your wife because of my getting involved in it. Why don't you get involved in it? And maybe Yaakov saying back to him, you know, they're all passive aggressives, right? Maybe Yaakov is saying, well, maybe you shouldn't have gotten involved in this, and look where you turned out, and now I have kids, and what do you want from me? But all of that is not said. Vatomer hine imati bilha bo eleha vatelad al birki ibne gam anochi mimena vatitain lo et bilha shivchata li isha vyavola Yaakov vatar bilha vatela li Yaakov ben vatomer rachel danani elokim vagam shama bikoli vatain li ben al ken karashmo dan. So therefore, the name of Dan is judgment. God has judged, God has decided, God has given me a child, which is actually Rachel's perspective. So when I said before, could Dan anyway, shape or form, be a proxy for Yosef or for his mother Rachel, coming from Rachel? The answer really is yes. Now, if we chose to continue on this path, there is a lot more to say. But I just want to be clear for a moment to make sure that we don't get lost over here. So I want to make sure that we don't get lost here. I want to make sure that everything makes sense, everything is clear. What I had suggested, just to understand the logic, the thinking about how we got to where we got to, that there's some kind of parallel between the four people who are in leadership positions when it comes to the war against Amalek and the four people who are involved now in terms of the battle... Sorry, in terms of the building of the Mishkan. Yes? Is that clear, or you're all someplace else? We lost you. We'll try again. We'll try again. We'll start from the beginning. We'll try again. So let's try that again. Those of you who are capable of focusing, I'll say it again. In the battle against Amalek, we have four tribes that stood out. Moshe on the mountain, flanked by Hur and Aaron, by Aaron as the Kohen, and then the other one is from Yehuda. Okay. Below is Yehoshua from the tribe of, from Ephraim, from Yosef, a ben Rachel. Okay. In this week's Parsha, when we're dealing with the building of the Mishkan, we're told Moshe is involved. That's one person. We're then told Itamar, the son of Aaron, not Aaron, the son of Aaron. So we have a replacement of Aaron, which makes a lot of sense. We then have Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. So somebody who is a replacement of Hur from Yehuda, who's there. So those three so far are perhaps somewhat predictable. Now, all of you who have a little bit of rabbinic knowledge know that there's a really bad background to this whole story about, hold it, why don't we just invite Hur? Why don't we just invite Aaron? Now, those two questions may have two different answers to them. Maybe Aaron being involved in the building is inappropriate because he was involved in the Chet HaEgel. Maybe Hur is not invited because he's dead. So those are good answers, but they're all a little frightening. So again, the other one was, why isn't Yehoshua here? So perhaps Yeshua has a different role. Yeshua's role is not the role in the Mishkan. He's not the Kohen. It doesn't have to do with this per se. If I would have picked, without knowing it's Dan, if I would have had to pick anybody, I actually would have picked somebody from Binyamin. I'm just pointing it out because Binyamin would make a lot of sense in terms of the eventual place where the Beit HaMikdash is going to stand. That when, and also you have a replacement of Yosef. You have a Ben Rachel. That would have been the logic over here. But logic doesn't always work. And now we go back to what you had pointed out is and that is that instead we're choosing somebody who is from Dan, and Dan is a replacement, I'm going to say it again, a proxy for Rachel, a proxy for Yosef, who isn't born yet at that time. And one more thing, and that goes back to the way that the camp is set up. So the way the camp is set up, and now you realize that really is quite important. Yehuda is all the way in the front, and you have Dan all the way in the back. Now, there is another thing there which is interesting, and that is that Yehuda, in a sense, are the Tzanchanim, right? Acharai, right? We're the first ones. They lead the way. They go off into battle, and that is the real leadership. Yehuda is flanked by Yisachar and Zvulun, which itself is really interesting, is that you have kingship needs on the one hand Torah, on the other hand needs business, right? But both of them are together there leading the way. There's no, I mean, again, nothing to be embarrassed, but that's what flanks Yehuda, and that is the start of the camp. At the very end of the camp, you have Dan, and Dan is called, of course, the Masef Kol HaMachanot. He's the one who picks up all the stragglers along the way, either in terms of possessions or in terms of people. By accident, we just now ended up with the war against Amalek once again, because it's those stragglers who were behind, the ones who were attacked, the ones who were not on the path, the ones who, in today's language, would be the ones who were off the derech. Those are the ones that were attacked, and Rashi says because they had a lack of belief. So the ones that had a lack of belief, they weren't in the cloud, they weren't in the camp, they straggled behind, and those are the ones who were attacked by Amalek, and those are the ones we go to war against Amalek for the ones who were the weakest ones in Emunah. So that's really interesting, because today's attitude is you just kick them out of yeshiva, you kick them out of the community, and Mechemet Amalek is actually you go to war in order to protect them. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, but who cares about biblical perspectives on things, because that's completely irrelevant to us. So anybody who heard what I said, you heard it. Anybody who didn't hear what I said, you don't have to ignore it. You didn't hear it, so it's fine. So what's interesting then is that even if I use the prototype of the war against Amalek as the background to all of this, I did just now bring Don into it, so I think that's interesting. The other thing that I don't think we should ignore, maybe we shouldn't be able to ignore, just maybe one more point before that, if you look at source number 15, there you have Machne Bnei Yehuda going first. That's Nachshon marching first. I know all of you know that Nachshon was the one who jumped in the water first. That's the Medrash. This is actually the Chumash, okay? So I know most of you are far more impressed, and you know the Medrash far better than you know the Chumash, but it actually doesn't say that in the Chumash as far as Nachshon jumping. But here Nachshon is leading the way in terms of the formation. He also is first when it comes to bringing the Korbanot. Yehuda is first. Nachshon is the Nasi. He's first over there. And the whole Midrash trying to explain why Yehuda is first, why Yehuda is bringing the first Korban and marching first. They go back and they bring the Nachshon Midrash as far as jumping in the water first, and that's what makes him first. But again, over here, he's first. And at the very end of that, it talks about they're the ones who at the very end, the one who catch up the stragglers. Rashi in source 16 will give you the different explanations of what that means, which I had hinted at before. In source 17, Vizot Lihuda is the bracha of Moshe. 18, okay, sorry, Pasukov Bed in source 17 is Ludan Mardan Gur Aryeh. And Rashi explains, Shehu omeid al hasvar v'shomer v'shoket sheli kansu eveim l'chol l'eretz Yisrael, that they're the ones who stand at the border and they protect in order to make sure that strangers don't come into the land of Israel. I do want to make a political point. Now they listen, okay? My political point has to do, and again, you don't need to learn these things from me, but what's interesting is that the tribe of Dan is on the tribe of the border. Okay, let me just say another thing about this, and then I'll get to the political point. Now that I got your attention. The tribe of Dan, actually, there are three other tribes that have something in common with Dan, and Dan is the outlier. So what are the three other tribes that have something in common with him? The three other tribes that have in common with him is that there are four firstborns. Reuven's a firstborn. Right? Who else is the first? Right? We have four people. We have four wives. Right? So you have who? You have Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah. So who are your four firstborn? Okay, so we have Yosef Dan. That was easy, and now you know, Reuven and the other one. So the other one is actually God. Oh God, I can't believe. Okay, so the other one is God. So actually, Yosef got replaced because Yosef got the double portion, so he has two. So therefore, the oldest one is Menashe. So Reuven, God, and Menashe. Isn't that an interesting group of three people? And the fourth one is Dan. Did anybody catch what I just now said? That the ones who stay on the other side of the border are Reuven, are all the displaced firstborns. All the ones that went to the therapist and say, I can't believe it, I lost the double portion, and what's going to be, and so on and so forth. By the way, Menashe is not necessarily involved in the beginning, and how not Menashe gets involved is strange because he's not there. It's Reuven and God. So who does Reuven go to when he gets upset? He goes to God, who's from Zilpah, which means Reuven's going to have the most influence on the firstborn from Zilpah, who is the one, the quote-unquote proxy, coming from Leah. So therefore, he's the one that he convinces to stay on the other side with him. Menashe, who at least according to Midrashim, got along with Ephraim, he actually gets a double portion. He gets a portion on both sides, and he gets the biggest portion. I mean, he basically got Texas. He got the whole Golan. He got an enormous amount of land. So it's really interesting what Menashe, but again, there is this commonality. Dan could have been a candidate. Now, Dan also got a double portion in Israel. When I say that the tribe of Dan had two different portions that were not next to one another, go and look at your maps and go study history. But Dan was really, it's really interesting that they're in two different places, which then goes back to this intrigue of being a firstborn and maybe double portion and so on. But Dan was on the border, Reuven and God and Menashe on the other side of the border. And they're the first ones to disappear. They're the first ones to go off into exile. Now, going back to my political point, that when you're at the border, so if you look at the map of America, let's say in terms of the last elections, you have your red states and the blue states. So the blue states are on the edges and the red states are there in the middle. And that's again, I'm being very superficial and I apologize for everything. But the big difference is going to be is that the blue states are going to be the states which are port cities, and those are the port cities which end up getting immigrants, and getting immigrants, they end up becoming multicultural, and multicultural, there's a lot of different influences, and it sort of changes the population. Kentucky doesn't work that way, okay? Iowa doesn't work that way. And I you know, can go on with the states in the middle, which are going to be very, very different from the states which are going to be on the ends. So there is, the one hand, there is going to be a synergy of different types of people coming in. On the other hand, and created by the different people coming in. But on the other hand, there's going to be different kinds of influences. One of the things about Dan is going to be the idolatry, which is going to become involved in Dan. And the Pesel Micha and some other things. And that's part of the problem of being on the border. That's part of the problem of being at the very end of the camp. That's probably, so over here we find when they get in, they're called Gur Aryeh because they're going to have to defend the border. That's exactly how Rashi did it. That was the Bechoshur. And the Balei HaTosfot say that in Source 18 because they're the ones defining the border. Because on the border, there's also not just other influence coming in, you can also foreign armies coming in. So that explains a little bit about. Now you go back to the Mishkan itself, and you have, you know, Yehuda and you have Dan, and they're the ones creating it. The other thing which is really interesting about it, and then we have to go back to actually the core of the Parsha, are the names involved. So Bitzalel, you have the idea, and the Midrash picks this up. It's the idea of Tzel, the idea of the Tzel-El being in the shadow of God. This is very connected to all of this because of the Tefillah of Moshe. If you look at the various Tehillim, which are Moshe's credited for, which go from basically 90 for the next 10, and you have Yoshev B'Seter Elyon and so on, B'Tzel Shakai Yitlona. That's one of the things that Moshe says. So this B'Tzel Hashem, the idea of the Shekhinah, the idea of being in the shadow of God, is really quite important. So his name, B'Tzalel, is we would say in Hebrew, it's Mahuti. How do you say that in English? Okay, so all the above, right? That's very good. You guys are great. You know, I'm a rabbi in a shul. Most of the people speak Hebrew. And I speak something really close to it. And whenever I want to get their attention, I say, how do you say this in Hebrew? And then they're all listening and they'll get involved. I'm telling you, I really know Hebrew. This is a pedagogical trip. I don't know Dikduk, but I know Hebrew. So they gave up on that. They don't even bother anymore. So if we go, if you then continue and look at the name of this person from Dan, Oholiav. So you have the word Ohel over there. You have this idea of creating some kind of tent, but you also have the father, and you also have Ben Achisamach, somebody whose brothers can trust or trust his brothers. But again, Dan is this tribe which takes care of the stragglers, takes care of all the others. So it's just an interesting, you know, identity over here. And let's try again now. We have this Mishkan being built. Moshe, Itamar, not Aaron, Bezalel, not Hur. Okay, we have a problem with Hur. Long, long time ago, I gave a class and I wrote about this, how that there's two Gemarot of significance. One, the Gemara says that when Bezalel is chosen, God says to Moshe, so what do you think about Bezalel? And Moshe says, well, he's good enough for you, he's good enough for me. So he says, go ask the people. So Moshe says to the people, well, what do you think about Bezalel? And the people say, well, he's good enough for you and God, then he's good enough for us. So he gets chosen. There's another Gemara that says that how old was Bezalel at this point? And it says he was 13 years old. So think of Bar Mitzvah present. Guess what you got? You know, we're giving you a Mishkan kit, you know. Have fun. The Haftarah is going to talk about Shlomo HaMelech, because Shlomo HaMelech is also somebody very young. He's 12 years old, and he's the one who actually builds the Beit HaMikdash. So you have a prototype over here of a young leader from Yehuda who's going to build, but there's much more to it, because back in Perek Lamed Aleph, when he's described, Bezalel, that is, when he's described, Re'ei Karati, which is also interesting, God saying, I called him. Re'ei Karati B'Shem, Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur l'mati Yehuda, v'amaleoto, I'm going to give him, I'm going to endow him with, Ruach Elokim b'chochma u'v'tfuna u'v'dat u'v'kol melacha. So he's going to have the Spirit of God, chochma, tfuna, and dat. So some of you who have ever heard of Chabad, so wisdom, chochma, tfuna, bina, v'dat, which those things sound pretty good. When Shlomo was chosen, he has a dream. Where did he have his dream? Around the corner from our house, correct? Maybe not even around the corner. Maybe right there. Right there. In Givon is where he had his dream. And surely, Givon is close enough to Givat Zev, right? We can claim it was right there, yes. So he has his dream, and God says, what do you ask for? And he asks for wisdom. You know, and then he wakes up and he figures out, you know, you all know the joke, like, who's his real mother-in-law? Okay, well, I'm not even going to tell it, but that's very funny. So, you don't know that? There are these two families who write to the Mashkiach in the yeshiva, and they each want them to send a bacher, yeshiva bacher, for their daughters. So two yeshiva bachurim are chosen. They told them, go take the train and go off to this little town over there, and you're gonna meet your wives. So they both go to the train station. One says to the other, what are you doing here? He goes, the Mashkiach told me that I'm going to meet my wife. And he told me the same thing. And he goes, yeah, married life is going to be great. He goes, what are you talking about? You're going to have to start working. You're going to have a woman. She's going to tell you what to do. It's much better to stay in yeshiva. And the other one says, no, I think it's better to be married. So the one says, you're out of your mind. I'm going back to yeshiva. So only one yeshiva bacha goes, gets to the train station. There are two families waiting for him. So one says, you know, this is our chassan for our daughter. This is for our one. They don't know what to do. They start to fight. So they go to the rabbi. And they say to the rabbi, listen, you know, I think it's our chassan. I think it's our chassan. So the rabbi starts thinking about Shlomo HaMelech. He says, okay, I think you should cut him in half. So one says, no, don't cut him in half. You know, it's okay. They can. Oh, there's no, cut him in half. Cut him in half. He goes, okay, that's the real mother-in-law. Okay. Okay, so now everyone has something to say for this week's Parsha. So again, coming back, what? It's so true. It's okay. The prototype of Bezalel, he is the prototype for Shlomo HaMelech. And also, if any of you have time to take a look at Yeshayahu, Perek Yud Aleph, you'll see that the person who's described as this branch coming out of Yishai from Yehuda, right, the whole same progeny, basically Mashiach, is going to have all of the qualities. And you look at the qualities described there in Perek Yud Aleph, it is all the qualities of Bezalel, all the qualities of Shlomo, and also all the qualities of David. They're all wrapped into one person, and then the Gemara, and then the Pasuk describes him as a Narkatan, as a young boy. He's then going to leave them, and wisdom's going to spread out that all over the world, which basically Mashiach follows the prototype of Bezalel. So therefore, Bezalel building the Mishkan is like Shlomo building the Beit HaMikdash, is like Mashiach building the Beit HaMikdash. So therefore, when you start thinking about who B'Tselu really is over here, but there's another point, who Hur really was, which means they killed David HaMelech. I mean, that's really what it is, which is really interesting because Hur is not here because his blood was spilled. Later on, we find David can't build the Mikdash because he spilled blood, but it's interesting that one has the grandson and one has his son involved in it, but this is all part of the same family, the same line. Now let's get back to our parsha to understand, because now that we avoided everything in Pekudei more or less, oh good, we can avoid it longer, yes. Right, I couldn't help myself. The reason is because I saw four people being pulled out. Three of them had to do, all four of them actually, had something to do with that Mechama against Amalek. So ultimately, the war against Amalek is a war in order to bring peace, as difficult as this may be, because wars are terrible and we don't like war and so on, but it's ultimately a war in order to create peace, because here are people who don't want there to be peace. Again, there you go and attack the innocent. And ultimately, the Beit HaMikdash is a battle of the Mishkan to bring peace, to bring Shlemut between man and between God. So therefore, maybe there is more of a parallel than we would have understood. So now, okay, Uri, okay, we spoke about him. Let's move on. Let's move on. So we're still in the first pasuk, source number one. Eile pukudei ha-mishkan, mishkan ha-idut. So in what sense is it a mishkan ha-idut? Let's take a look down in source number five. It says, maho ha-idut. What exactly is this ha-idut? So Omer Rav Shimon ben Rebbe Yishmael, ha-idut hi l'kol boi ha-olam she-shlicha li-Yisrael. It's a sign for the entire world that the Jews have been forgiven. What's really interesting about that formulation? Who cares about the entire world? I should have thought, or I would have thought, it's a sign for the Jews they've been forgiven. So before my father says it, I'll already tell you that this is a response to a Christian polemic where the Jews have been rejected, the Jews have been replaced. If the Jews sin, therefore they've lost their place as a holy people. There's a new Israel, and the new Israel's the church, and the new Israel's the Vatican, and so on and so forth, so you no longer need Israel. The Kol Bay Olam is really interesting, but I want to read a little bit further in the same Midrash. Go down a couple of lines. Kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then to line, Hu Chibei Bet Yisrael, that's bolded. God loved us. Vivem lefnei har Sinai, and he brought us to Sinai, still in source 5. And Natan lemet Torah, he gave us the Torah. Ukaran mamlechet kohanim, and he called us a kingdom of priests. V'nema v'tem tiyulim lechet kohanim, achar bam yom chatu. And after 40 days they sinned. Otosha amru ovde kochavim, eino mitratzelem od. And then the non-Jews of the world said, that's it, the Jews at this point have been rejected. The Jews have, so I'm going to say it again, the theme of the Jews being rejected is a theme which is going to be taken up by other religions afterwards. I don't know to what extent the Jews being rejected as God's people is really a theme which we find at earlier stages. And he quotes a pasuk in Eicha, which of course should be of extreme interest and significance. Amru b'goyim lo yusifu l'gor kevin shalach Moshe l'vakesh rachmem aleihem yad salach l'makadosh baruch hu shenemar v'yomer shem salachti kidbaracha. And Moshe then prayed and God forgave them and God said salachti kidbaracha, which is a fascinating pasuk to use. I've pointed this out before, but this pasuk completely is out of, it makes no sense that it's here. Those of us who say slichot, it makes sense because we say the yugur gemil midot, and then God says salachti kidbarecha. The reason it doesn't really make sense is because if you look at the source of this is Bamidbar Yudalid. This salachti kidbarecha is never mentioned after the egel. Salachti kidbarecha is only after the chedah meraglim. So over here, this midrash already does what we have in the slichot. It throws in the salachti kidbarecha as a response to Moshe's davening for them after the egel. But then it continues, Amar Moshe, Ribbono Olam, Areidi Mefuyas Shemachalta L'Yisrael, Ela Hodia La'inei Kol Umot She'in Bilibcha Aleihem, Amalo Kadosh Baruch Hu Chayach Areidi Mesharei Shechinati B'tocham. That according to this midrash, the building of the Mishkan, that God's presence is with the people, is the makeup, is the way that God shows the world that he has forgiven the Jews because the Shekhinah remains with them. And it continues, Vasuli Mikdash Umakim Shemachalta Lahem, which again goes all the way back. This is Rashi, that the building of the Mishkan is after the Chet Egel, and therefore God says, the Kach Nemar Mishkan Ha'idut She'idut Hi L'Yisrael Shemachal L'Makadosh Baruch Hu, that this is evidence that God has forgiven the Jewish people, the fact that the Mishkan will be built. So that is something which is really important over here, but it's also going to help us frame what's going on. And the elements over here that we need, therefore, to identify and to put together is that the building of the Mishkan, at least according to this Midrashic understanding, and I do want to stress something, even if we take the Ramban, and the Ramban's point is that things are in their proper sequence, still the implementation of building the Mishkan only takes place afterwards, which is even according to the Ramban, there's going to be and maybe it's even stronger, but let me explain my point. There's going to be some real tension. Okay, they get the instructions to build it beforehand. they do the golden calf. So who in the world said that afterwards the Mishkan's going to work? Do you understand what I'm saying is going to work? You're going to put all the pieces together, and then you're going to turn the engine. Is it going to work? Who said it's going to work afterwards? Who said the Shekhinah is going to come down and fill the place up? Which means, I'm going to say this either way, that especially if you feel the guilt of sin, and the guilt of sin is one, you know, of distancing from God, you're going to build the Mishkan. How do you know it's going to actually work at the end? When I said that the book ends with a happy ending, so what is the happy ending? Just one more second. What is the happy ending? The happy ending is that the Shekhinah actually comes down, fills the place up, and it works. So I just remember I said before, those of you from the very beginning, I said that the ending of the book of Shemot and the beginning of the book of Vayikra is actually a very similar ending. How so? At the end of Vayikra, what did we have? We had a long, long tochcha. If you do this, and you do this, and you do this, you're going to be rejected. And at the very end, it says, but I'm going to bring you back. Right? I'm going to remember the covenant. I'm going to bring you back. And right afterwards, what do we have? We have the parsha of Temura, that once you declare something is holy, it can't become unholy. So I felt the parsha of Temura at that particular place, after we have the whole rejection of Israel as it was, because Israel rejected God, but saying, no, something can't lose its holiness. I felt that that was actually incredible, that therefore the book really has to end at this point where God doesn't reject the Jewish people. It doesn't work that way. There's a covenant, and the covenant is forever, and therefore even if we mess up, we still retain the holiness. Again, there's consequences. There could be a galut, but we do come back, and we retain the holiness. So I'm saying if that's the case, so now realize that the book of Shemot went and spelled out something, or lives out, covenant, rejection, Shekhinah returns. The same theme which happens in Vayikra. Okay, you're going to mess up, you're going to reject, but there's still a covenant, and there's still going to be Kedusha, and it's not going to end, which means the theme of it is really the same. One, of course, playing it out in real time, and the other telling you what's going to happen in the future. I gave a class, I don't remember now if it was last night, yesterday, whatever, and I said that that pasuk is actually one of the most important psukim to understand what's taking place over here, because they're dealing with what could have been and what's actually going to happen, and what's going to happen, that the Shekhinah is actually going to be with them, is something that you just can't take for granted, because that was, you know, I don't know, in question. That was not simple. That was... Let's continue, because I want to keep in mind, so you have Moshe's heroism on the one hand, but I want to keep in mind something else when we look at source number 3. I don't want to read all the words. You know, sometimes we don't like to read the words because they're hard, but I just want you to read the words that are bolded. What words are those? They did this, and this. They did Kasher Tziva Hashem et Moshe. They did this, and this. Kasher Tziva Hashem et Moshe. They did that. Kasher Tziva Hashem et Moshe. Is there a theme over here? The theme is one of obeyance. The theme is one of acceptance. The theme is one that God has commanded, and they are actually listening. They are doing that which they're being told to do. That's really important when you have a people that didn't listen and people that built a golden calf. See, what I'm getting at is that there's a process taking place. And it could be that we're too focused on the result and not focused enough on the process. The result is, right, a lot of us have result-oriented thinking, build the Mishkan, Mishkan works. Okay, check, that was good. But it's not just building the Mishkan. It's not just the result of having a Mishkan built. Let me put it that way. It's not just having a built Mishkan. It's actually the process of building it is one which is quite important. Whereby I'm going to go back again, and the various tribes involved in it really are important, but it's more than that. Over here at the in Pasuk Lamed Bet, it says Vatechal kol avodat haMishkan o Moed vayisu bnei Yisrael kechol asher tziva Hashem et Moshe kenasu. Right, they did everything, and I'll say again now, all of Parshat Pekudei could have been that one pasuk. I didn't need the rest of it. They did everything that God told, that God commanded Moshe. They did everything, and that's it. I did not need all the details. Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Vayaviu et Mishkan El Moshe, et Oel Moed, et Oel Vet Kol Kelav, and so on and so forth. Vayar Moshe et Kol Macha, Vihine, Asu Oto Kasher Tziva Hashem, Kein Asu, Vayavorech et HaMoshe. So it's completed. Now, this is something which should not have been obvious, because Moshe really had very little to do with all of this. Right? Bezalel did it. Right? Others did it. The various artisans did it. I'm sure they had donations on all the walls. You know, this donated by this family and so on. I'm not kidding. You see that clearly in the Mishnah regarding Bayit Sheni, the various donations. But what did Moshe have to do with all of this? Moshe was not involved in the building of the Mishkan, although it does say on source number 4, Perek Mem, V'yedibar Hashem Moshe lemor, B'yom HaChodesh HaRishon Be'elchod LaChodesh, that actually is really important. We'll come back to that in a second. Takim et Mishkan Olam Moed. What does Takim mean? Moshe is commanded to make the Mishkan operational. Let me come back to the second, but first the date. There are two possibilities of you understanding the significance of this date. Right? It says, B'chodesh HaRishon, B'chad L'chodesh. Well, that sounds, yeah, what is the significance? So good. So you got all from on us, excellent, or religious, and therefore, HaChodesh is Elachem, this is the beginning of the Jewish people, you're a nationalist, this is the beginning of Jewish time, right? Beforehand things used to work. This is when God tells it, right? So this is the 1 year anniversary of the beginning of the redemption. I don't know, it's very hard to say when's the beginning of the redemption. It's when Moshe walks out of the palace the first. When's the beginning of redemption? But the beginning of the end of leaving Egypt is actually the first of the month. And they're going to leave, you know, 10 days later they're going to get the animals and they're going to put in the doorpost and slaughter it and the Korban Pesach, and then they're going to leave 15 days. So this is the beginning of the end, Rosh Chodesh. So this is the 1 year anniversary, so therefore I can look at it in terms of national terms. But I can also look at it in different terms, which is based upon a machloket, and we know the machloket in Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua, and the machloket is, when was the world created? Which means, is this not just the beginning of Jewish time, is this actually the beginning of time? Which means, do we have a whole new world being created? What I'm really saying is there now a parallel between the building of the Mishkan and the building of the world, as it were? Now, one of the things we're going to see along the way is that Moshe actually tried a number of times to build it, and it wasn't so simple. He tried a first time, tried a second time, tried a third time, and that, of course, is reminiscent to the source right under number 4, which doesn't have a number, where it says that God actually created worlds and destroyed worlds, which is very difficult for us to understand. But when you'll use that as a parallel, then, if this is the same time, this is creation, this is the beginning, but it's a new beginning. So I would have thought the new beginning would have been, and again, this is the point of Rabbi Yoshua, that the world actually begins in the spring. The spring is when everything comes to life. The spring is the time of creation. The spring is the time of the Jews leaving Egypt, which has to always be in the spring. That's the reason our calendar is the way it is, because the spring is the issue over here. And the world is created in the spring. I know that you all think that we follow Rabbi Eliezer and the world is created in Tishrei, but right, because that's Rosh Hashanah, and it's very strange that Rosh Hashanah is in the seventh month. So it's the months begin in the spring, but the years begin in the fall, which is a very strange thing. But keep in mind, even the prayer that you're going to bring to me as evidence, Hayom Harat Olam, does not mean that the world was given birth on that day. Rather, the world got pregnant on that day. Hayom Harat Olam doesn't mean it's the birthday of the world. I don't know how they translate it in English, Hayom Harat Olam. The other thing is, I actually have a halacha, which, if you have good memories, if you do this around 10 times in your life, it's a skula for long life. I have a proof from halacha that the world was actually created in the spring. What is my proof? What's the skula? What? Berachat Hachama. So why is it a skula for long life if you do it 10 years, 10 times? Because you do it every 28 years. So that is a bracha that you make when the world is in the exact alignment that it was when it was created. Do we say this bracha in the spring, or do we say this bracha in the fall? We say it in the spring, which apparently means that, at least on some level, in terms of Jewish law, we're assuming the world was actually created in the spring. So deal with that. So it's really interesting then that on the first day of the first month is when the Mishkan, this is a new beginning, and I know that last year we had a new beginning, and the new beginning last year was the beginning of the Jews leaving Egypt, but now we have a new beginning, and I would have thought the new beginning is the new beginning of, but it's the new beginning of a people forgiven. That's really what I'm saying is the backdrop of all that. It's a new world of people being forgiven. As much as you would have thought that, no, that's the idea of forgiveness and judgment and all, that's a Rosh Hashanah thing, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and so on. But over here, you have this brand new sparkling Mishkan, and I'm going to say it again, and the whole tension is going to be, is this going to work or is not going to work? And it does work, which means that we were actually, indeed, we were forgiven. Now, a couple of more points about this. In source number 8, there's a midrash that says, Vayaviu et Mishkan, Kaven Sha'asu Yisrael at the Mishkan, lo hayodim hakimo. They made it. They didn't know how to build it. Elokol achad v'chad hivi melachto zelmar krasai v'zelmar krasai. You know, I donated this and I did this and I did this. V'shirta ruach hakodesh al Moshe Rabbeinu v'hikimo. That it was Moshe was the one who did it. So that's very important, and I'll come back to that in one more moment. There's just one halacha that I want to deal with first, and that goes back to source number 1. Eile Pikudei HaMishkan. What is the Pikudei? The Pikudei has to do with counting. What are we counting? Eile Pikudei HaMishkan Mishkan Eidut Asher Pukad Al Pi Moshe. So again, that sounded like too many words the first time we read it, but what does this mean, Al Pi Moshe? Moshe is the one who's doing the... So Moshe does have a job. What's Moshe's job? Moshe's doing the counting. What are we counting? And the answer is going to be, as you continue, you're going to find in Pasuk Kaf Dalet and Kaf Hei and so on, there's a whole lot of gold going around and a whole lot of silver going around. So let me tell you a halacha. When you have a charitable organization or organization that deals with charity, if it's your own money and you're the sole, you know, it's your money and you get to choose what you do with your money, you can do anything you want and give it to anyone you want. But if it's a communal charity, then it's inappropriate for one person to be in charge of that charity. I'm saying this is actually a halacha. You should have multiple people in charge of it, and for multiple reasons. One reason is one person can make a mistake. The other reason is the person can make a mistake on purpose. The other reason is that people could think that the person's making a mistake on purpose, which means that it's not right for one person to be in charge. You bring a number of trustworthy people in charge, and they're the ones who together, as a collective, give out the money. So that's the first point. So why is Moshe doing this by himself? So I'm saying this is a problem. Now, the one who really identifies this and discusses this, and it's not a short piece, is the Or HaChaim in source number 12. Ode, when you realize it starts with Ode, you realize this long Or HaChaim is actually much longer. Okay? Ode Yirtza'al Zaderech Liot Shemosha Asah HaMispar Yisrael Muva. Saying no, that what Moshe did was actually true. Pirish al derech omro, elohim o'adai, and so on. We'll skip a little bit. Katam ki lo ya hazulati mo latzdik. There was no one with him. Elami piv anuchayim. We had to trust him. V'chum ufrei Moshe shulav adola kachakol. Moshe did all this by himself. V'ta'amo shemoshe shevi atzmo lidei achshad. And he says, but realize that Moshe now placed himself under possible suspicion. So if you got what he said, he's dancing around my problem, but I want to explain it, but actually give an answer, which is, I think, a little clearer than what he's saying. He's saying, okay, you have to trust Moshe. If you don't trust Moshe, essentially, who are you going to trust, right? If you don't trust Moshe, you may as well just throw away the whole Torah. I mean, it's not that, Moshe, we trust you that you told us that you have to do this, this, and this, and you can't do this, and this, but we want someone else looking into the money over here, okay? We don't trust you. You know, these are Jews. What do you want? These are Jews. But part of the sin of the golden calf was rejection of God. But part of the sin of the golden calf was also a devaluation of Moshe. Moshe Ha'ish, Moshe the person. Moshe can't be coming back. Moshe is no longer with us. And there needed to be a tikkun over here, a fixing, in terms of who Moshe is. So therefore, when we go back and just think about the parsha, Moshe is the one who puts the Mishkan up. Nobody else can do it. You have the best artisans and all kinds of people. They're trying, but nobody else can do it. Moshe, with Ruach HaKodesh, goes over to the Mishkan, and now the Mishkan sort of comes to peace. I don't know how to describe this. But it's essentially just by itself, these things just coming, being formed, and right in front of you, you have a whole built Mishkan. And that's really what happens over here, according to the description, is that Moshe, and again, there's a long midrash in that we had skipped, that Moshe doesn't know how to do it. And Moshe says Moshe can't do it, but rather, and the Or HaChaim quotes a lot of this, but rather it's Moshe who needs to do it, because the people need to see that it's Moshe doing it. Which brings me back to the point. If you can't trust Moshe, you may as well get rid of the whole Torah. And part of the rejection of Moshe in terms of the Chet of the golden calf is really, they got rid of the whole Torah. That's exactly the point. You got rid of Moshe, you don't listen to Moshe, so now you end up with an ego. So now there needs to be, trust in Moshe needs to be built. And therefore, yeah, Moshe's going to deal with all the money. Why? You have to trust him. What do you mean I have to? No, you have to trust him. Because if you don't trust him, then the whole thing is going to fall apart. So even though in any other case it would be inappropriate for one individual to be in charge of the counting and so on, this is part of the healing that's going to take place. Which means what I'm getting at, and again, I said this before and I want it to be really clear now, that the whole Mishkan is going to be built and all the best people can do it. But the process is important. And that process needs to end up with Moshe being in charge of the money, Moshe putting it up, and ultimately Moshe then being prepared to hear the voice of God come down and talk to him, which unfortunately is not this week's parasha, but that's already next week's parasha. But where do we end? We end with a happy note. Yes, we left Egypt. That's good. Right? We had all the miracles. The sea was split. We got to Har Sinai. We were as one people. We heard the word of God. And then the whole story took a bad turn. And at that point, we could have been rejected. Maybe we should have been rejected. And maybe logic would dictate that the Jews are no longer God's people. No. We can sin, but God's presence is still with us. And there's even a possibility that Rashi takes of the whole enterprise of the Mishkan, this whole concept of nearness of God being normally the heavens of heavens can't contain God, and God saying, no, I'm going to do it Tzimtzum, I'm going to come down, I'm going to fill this world up with holiness, with divinity. Maybe all of that was because there was a sin, and now that sin was healed. Maybe this really tells us this message that in a place that a Baal Tshuva stands, that Tzadik Gomer couldn't have stood. Maybe the Jewish people now, after they've sinned and have done Tshuva, so now God says, okay, now we're going to be much closer than we were before. Again, it's this metaphor that I love, that you can have a relationship with God as sort of like a rope. And what happens when the rope, when you sin, then you cut the rope. What happens if you do Tshuva? You tie a knot in it. And that knot becomes very strong. That rope can break any place except where the knot is. But what happens when you have a knot on the rope? The rope is much shorter than it was before you started, which means the distance to God now has become smaller. Now we're closer to God, and now there's going to be more Shechina in the world. But, and that's the result, and that's why the book ends. Despite all the bad things that happened, the book ends at a really good note, because things are fixed. But Moshe has to be a part of this process. They have to trust Moshe. They have to believe in Moshe. Because without that, everything can unravel all over again. And there we go. The book of Shemot, even though who would have predicted it, you know, a couple of chapters back, it really ends in a good place. Chazak, chazak, v'nitchazek.